I'm sure many of you will remember in February 1989 when the Ayatollah Khomeini pronounced a fatwa ordering the execution of Salman Rushdie following the publication of Rushdie's controversial book, The Satanic Verses. And shortly after that pronouncement was made, Rushdie went into hiding, and then from hiding he published these words. This is what he said. I want to see what you make of this. He said, "The heart of what they're angry about is not the specific insults in the book. It's to do with the whole notion of doubt. Doubt, it seems to me, is the central condition of human beings in the late 20th century. One of the things that has happened to us in the 20th century as a human race is to learn how certainty crumbles in your hands. We cannot any longer have a fixed, certain view of anything. The table that we're sitting next to, the ground beneath our feet, the laws of science, they are all now full of doubt. Everything we know is pervaded by doubt and not by certainty." Well, I don't know what you make of that. I think there's probably an extent to which he's right about our society today. I'm not sure about on a deep philosophical level, but certainly on the surface, I think that's probably true. And there's a sense in which we need to be doubtful and sceptical in order to survive today, isn't there? I think if we fell for every media gimmick and spin that's on offer, then, well, we'd probably end up being the laughingstock of our friends, penniless, and perhaps signed up to a few cults as well. I use Lynx deodorant, but despite the adverts, I'm not disappointed every time I spray my deodorant that I don't immediately become more attractive to the opposite sex. It might get rid of a few unattractive aromas, but I'd be a fool to be taken in to the extent that the adverts portray. It's second nature to us, isn't it, not to believe what we read in the newspaper or what we hear on Prime Minister's Question Time. And so it's no wonder that when we come to Thomas, this figure that we affectionately know as Doubting Thomas, we feel he's one of us, don't we? We have a real empathy with Thomas, I think, as 21st century people. He's a true 21st century skeptic, this man. His attitude is, give me the bare facts, give me visible evidence, and I'll make my own mind up. Thank you very much. I'm not going to take your word for it. And we get a sense of this. John, in his gospel, he builds up a picture for us of what this character Thomas is like, building up towards this final episode about Thomas at the end of his gospel. And so I want us just to pick up on a few hints that John gives us about what Thomas is like. So if you'll turn back to me briefly to John chapter 11. There's two occasions in John's gospel other than the passage we're looking at where Thomas is mentioned, and this is the first of them. John 11, the beginning of this chapter, Jesus hears that his friend Lazarus is sick, is unwell, and he decides eventually to go to Lazarus's home in Judea. And we read in verses 7 and 8 of this chapter, "And Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let us go back to Judea.' 'But Rabbi,' they said, 'a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there?' But when Jesus still persists that they will go to Judea, along comes Thomas with a ton weight of brutal, hard-nosed facts. In verse 16, read with me there, "Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, 'Let us also go that we may die with him.'" Well, in fairness to Thomas, he shows real loyalty here, doesn't he, to Jesus? But perhaps not the most optimistic and uplifting guy to have around as part of your team. He's a realist, and he brings things back down to earth with a realistic thud. And then flick over to John 14, the second time that that Thomas is mentioned in John's gospel. John chapter 14. This time the disciples are in the upper room. It's the Last Supper before Jesus is betrayed and tried and executed. And Jesus is speaking words of comfort to his disciples. We'll just read the first few verses of John 14. Jesus says to them, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the place, the way to the place where I am going." And then Thomas comes sweeping in, like Jeremy Paxman, with a heavy dose of reality check. Verse 5, Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way?" Brutally honest, "None of this spiritual mumbo jumbo for me, thank you," says Thomas. "I don't know the way, I don't know what you're talking about, please explain." And so we have this picture built up for us of Thomas being like that. Incidentally, Jesus follows those words with words of absolute certainty and assurance, doesn't he? Verse 6, these famous words, Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." But Thomas is this brutally honest skeptic. I've heard it said that if Thomas were British, he'd probably be a Yorkshireman. And I think we can kind of see the resonance of that in what we've just read. And we see it again in the passage we're looking at this morning. So let's turn back to John 20. And I want us to consider verses 24 to 31 of this passage this morning. And we'll look at it in three sections just to help us guide our way through it. We'll look at verses 24 and 25, Thomas doubts. And then 26 to 28, Thomas believes. And then the last three verses, Thomas rebuked. Thomas doubts then. Verse 24, we read that Thomas for some reason was absent when the other disciples had met the week before and Jesus had appeared to them. We aren't told why that is. Perhaps chances are that he was upset by Jesus' death and maybe wanted to spend some time alone as a result. So we don't know why for sure though. But the disciples come to him with this outrageous news in verse 25. They say, "We have seen the Lord." And Thomas, well, he's incredulous, isn't he? Once again, we see the skeptic Thomas. He wants the bare facts. He wants visible evidence on which to make up his own mind. He's not going to take their word for it. He wants to see all the gory details before he's willing to believe. And so he makes his demands. Verse 25, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hands into his sides, I will not believe it." Thomas wants to see a physical continuity between the Jesus who he had seen die on the cross a few days earlier with nails in his hand and a spear in his side. He wants to see a physical continuity between that Jesus and this figure that the disciples are saying that they have seen. And unless he does that, he won't believe. And there's a sense, isn't there, in which it's great that there's someone like Thomas around at this point in John's description of what happens. Because there's one common theory, isn't there, as to how claims of Jesus' resurrection came about. And that's this idea that Jesus' early disciples, well, following Jesus' death, they were a bit emotionally shaken and understandably heartbroken by Jesus' death. And therefore, they're a bit more inclined to believe the impossible, that Jesus had risen again. Perhaps they had this kind of sense that Jesus' spirit was with them. And so they kind of conjured up this idea that, well, that's kind of like Jesus has risen again. So that's what we'll tell people has happened. And the legend, the myth grew from there. But the presence of Thomas here, well, it seems to go a long way, doesn't it, in discrediting that theory. I don't know about you, but from what we've seen of Thomas, I can't imagine him standing for any of that kind of spiritual mumbo-jumbo. He's a guy who would only be convinced by the real deal, by a real physical risen Jesus Christ, with real concrete physical evidence for it. So in a sense, we're glad Thomas is here. And I guess a lot of us can sympathise with Thomas. I wonder if you'd put yourself in his category this morning. Just give me unclouded, undistorted evidence. Let me see for myself, and then I'll believe. Thomas doubts. But then, moving on, well, Thomas believes. Verses 26 to 28. The amazing thing in these verses is that Thomas gets exactly the evidence that he has demanded from Jesus. Verse 26, we see that this time Thomas, he's with the other disciples as they met together. And Jesus appears to them, and again Jesus appears in this miraculous way. I think that's worth noting. There's a suggestion here that whilst Jesus' body was still very much a physical body after he'd risen again, we see that in the next verse, and yet there was something remarkably different about it. In verse 27 then, we see that Jesus, he presents Thomas with this exact evidence, meeting Thomas's exact demands that he's made. Word for word, he repeats Thomas's demands, doesn't he, from verse 25, and invites Thomas to examine the evidence for himself. But Jesus adds this challenge on the end, this command on the end of verse 27. He says, stop doubting and believe. Literally, stop disbelieving and believe. Stop doing one thing and do the complete opposite, Thomas. Stop doubting and believe. And it seems that the mere invitation to examine the evidence is enough for Thomas. We aren't told that he goes to the lengths even of touching Jesus. Just the mere sight of Jesus with the nail marks in his hands is enough for Thomas. And so Thomas, the 21st century skeptic, drops to his knees and says, Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God, verse 28. We have this remarkable confession. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. And I want us to notice a few things about this confession of belief that Thomas makes here. The first thing is this, that Thomas ends up believing a lot more than he doubted. Thomas ends up believing a lot more than he doubted. That probably doesn't make sense, so let me try and explain what I mean by that. Verse 25, we read, Thomas said, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hands into his side, I will not believe it. Well, what is it that Thomas will not believe? What is it that he's not willing to agree with? Well, it's that the other disciples have seen Jesus, isn't it? It's that they've seen Jesus alive again. In other words, Thomas will not believe that Jesus has risen from the dead. That's what he refuses to believe. It's in verse 28, Thomas confesses far more, doesn't he, than just that Jesus has risen from the dead. He now believes that Jesus is his Lord and his God, that Jesus is God himself. See, what Thomas seems to have realized very quickly is that if Jesus has risen from the dead, well, then he must be Thomas's Lord and Thomas's God. There's no other explanation. There's no other alternative available to him. The resurrection can't be construed in any other way other than to reach this conclusion that Jesus is his Lord and his God. And so if you're convinced this morning that history indicates that Jesus really did rise from the dead, well, you can't just leave it there. You have to go the whole hog, just as Thomas did. You have to confess that Jesus must also be God. He must be your Lord and your God. Notice as well that this is a very personal confession. Thomas confesses, my Lord and my God. The one of whom Thomas has just been making these demands, Thomas suddenly realizes is the one who could rightfully demand anything of Thomas. He's his rightful Lord and his rightful God, the Lord of his life. And notice as well that this is the confession that counts. I think John very much makes this point clearly throughout his gospel, that it's building towards this confession of Thomas. This is a really important passage in John's gospel. Let's turn back briefly to John chapter 1 that we read right at the beginning of the service, just to see this work through. In verse 1 we read, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning." So John begins with this claim that the Word, Jesus Christ, well, he is God. Just as Thomas was saying, "My Lord and my God." That's where John begins. Verse 14 as well. "This Word became flesh and has made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." The "we" in that verse, it makes sense that we understand that to be primarily the disciples. John's talking about we, me and my friends, the disciples. We have seen his glory, the glory of the Word, the one and only Jesus Christ. We've seen it and we testify to it. And then in verse 18, just on a similar theme, "No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known." So John sets up this expectation in this opening section. Incidentally, if you're looking at John's Gospel and you're trying to see how a passage in John's Gospel fits in with the rest of the book, then a good place to start is by going to those first 18 verses where John sets up a lot of the themes in his Gospel, which he continues throughout the Gospel. So you may find that useful. But John sets up this expectation that the disciples will see the glory of the one and only Jesus Christ, who is God. That they'll see and understand that he is this one and only. And we can trace the development of that understanding in the disciples through John's Gospel. I've just picked out a few places where this happens. I think they'll come up on the screen to save you having to flick through. The first one's quite soon at the beginning of the Gospel. And we read this, just after Jesus turned water into wine. "This, the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed in Cana of Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him." And then we see, moving on to chapter 6. Verse 67, Jesus says to them, "You do not want to leave too, do you?" Jesus asked the 12. And then we have this remarkable confession from Peter. "Simon Peter answered him, 'Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God.'" And then moving a lot further on to chapter 16, the end of their discussion in the upper room the night before Jesus was executed. "Then Jesus' disciples said, 'Now you are speaking clearly and without figures of speech. Now we can see that you know all things and that you do not even need to have anyone ask you questions. This makes us believe that you came from God.' 'You believe at last,' Jesus answered." And so we see the disciples building up this understanding. Firstly, they put their faith in Jesus. He's someone that they see as trustworthy. They can put their faith in. Then they acknowledge that he's the Holy One of God. Then they believe that he came from God. But it's not until you reach chapter 20 with Thomas's confession, this confession that really counts, that we see echoes of chapter 1 and verse 1. "Jesus is God, my Lord and my God," says Thomas. This is the fulfillment of that expectation that John has at the beginning, that the disciples will see the glory of the one and only and believe. This is the confession that really counts, that Jesus isn't just one sent from God. He's not just the Holy One of God who we can trust, but he is Lord and God. He's Thomas's Lord and Thomas's God, and he's your Lord and your God. Do you believe this? Have you made the confession that really counts? Well, let's move on. Thomas believes, but then Thomas is rebuked as well in these last few verses. Despite his eventual belief, Jesus doesn't fully endorse Thomas's skepticism. There's this kind of implicit rebuke, isn't there, in verse 29. Let's look down at that together. Verse 29, "Then Jesus told him, 'Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed.'" I'm wary of being more harsh on Thomas here than Jesus is. I don't want to do that. But at the very least, Jesus seems to be saying that Thomas could and perhaps should have believed without the visible evidence that he demanded from Jesus. I think that's the very least that Jesus is saying in rebuke of Thomas here. But even so, isn't it a bit harsh to criticize Thomas in this way? After all, Thomas was only demanding, wasn't he, the same evidence as the other disciples had had. He wasn't asking for anything more than they had already seen and believed. And we see that come across very clearly in this chapter, chapter 20. John's very clear that the other disciples sense Jesus. They use their physical senses to see and hear and touch Jesus. And that's the basis on which they believe. That comes across very clearly. Let's notice the emphasis in this chapter. Beginning of chapter 20, verse 1, Mary Magdalene saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Verse 5, John himself, talking about himself here, he bent over and looked in at the strips of linen. Verse 6, Peter saw the strips of linen lying there. Verse 8, John saw and believed. Verse 14, Mary turned round and saw Jesus standing there. 15, Jesus says to Mary, "Who is it you are looking for?" 17, Jesus says, "Do not hold on to me," to Mary, the implication being that Mary had been physically holding on to Jesus at that point. Verse 18, Mary reports back, "I have seen the Lord." Verse 20, we read, after he said this, he showed them his hands and his sides. And then verse 22, Jesus breathed on the disciples. The physical senses, they're all in play here, aren't they? The disciples have seen, heard, and even touched Jesus. And that's the basis on which they have believed. Verse 8, I think, makes it especially clear. John, talking about himself, says, "He saw and believed." So what's wrong with Thomas demanding this same evidence for himself? What's the problem with that? Why the rebuke? Well, to understand it, I think we need to see here that Jesus uses this opportunity to teach Thomas and us something very important about what true Christian faith or true Christian belief is. And so let's spend a few minutes just looking at that. What Jesus teaches us is that true Christian belief or faith is not based on sight. True belief or faith is not based on sight. And we see that in verse 29, don't we? Surely this is Jesus' point here. "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus is saying it's possible to believe without seeing. It's possible to do that. It's not just possible, but Jesus looks forward to a time where people will be blessed for doing so. Well, that's a ludicrous statement, isn't it? Isn't that completely balmy? The 21st century Thomas inside each one of us is crying out and saying, "Well, that's crazy. How can you believe something without proof? I want proof. I want evidence. I want to see it." But isn't this something we do all the time in everyday life? I believe that the blue whale exists, although I've never seen one in the flesh with my own physical eyes. If I did see one in the flesh with my own physical eyes, I wouldn't believe any more than I already do that it existed. I wouldn't suddenly think, "Oh, now I really believe that the blue whale exists." I already believe it exists. And you might say, "Well, that doesn't really change your life. How's that important whether you believe the blue whale exists or not? It's not very important at all." Well, let's think about something that is potentially life-changing that we believe on the same basis. Those of you who are married, why do you believe your husband or your wife loves you? Why do you believe that? Well, I assume you've taken them for brain scans and blood tests at the local hospital to get the necessary empirical evidence to prove that they love you. No? Well, of course not. And yet you still believe that they love you. And so Jesus says, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." But John goes on to teach us a second point, which adds to what Jesus is saying here. It's a second point about true belief and faith. And we see it in verses 30 and 31. And what John teaches us here is that whilst true belief of faith is not based on sight, it is also not without evidence. Whilst true belief of faith is not based on sight, it is also not without evidence. I'm sure many of you have read or know of this exchange between the Queen and Alice in Lewis Carroll's book, Through the Looking Glass. It goes like this. The Queen says to Alice, "Now I'll give you something to believe. I'm just 101, 5 months and a day." "I can't believe that," said Alice. "Can't you?" the Queen said in a pitying tone. "Try again. Draw a long breath and shut your eyes." Alice laughed. "There's no use trying," she said. "One can't believe impossible things." "I dare say you haven't had much practice," said the Queen. "When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." And lots of people today have this view of faith, don't they? They have this view of what it means to have faith. It's like drawing a breath, shutting your eyes, and trying to believe something impossible with all your might. I'm sure many of you who are Christians here this morning have had someone say to you at some point, "I wish I had your faith," or something along those lines. I know people have said that to me in the past, and I've thought, what do they mean by that? And I guess the impression that we get generally is that effectively that means, I wish I had that spook inside you, that ability to remain optimistic and clinging on to your belief against all reason and rational evidence. In other words, you're a complete wacko, but you're a nice wacko, and it seems to work for you. I guess that's what people might mean by that. And that's quite a common view of faith, isn't it? The idea that faith is this kind of optimistic leap in the dark, an irrational launching of yourself off a cliff in the hope that something or someone will catch you. But John rejects that with what he says in verses 30 and 31. Let's read those together, shall we? "Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." John's claim is that belief in Jesus Christ is based on evidence. It's believing on the basis of good and adequate reasons. It's on the basis of credible eyewitness accounts. Notice verse 30, John is definite in emphasizing Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples. The disciples were there, they saw them, and there were so many of them that he couldn't write them all down, but he's written some of them down in order that we may believe. So on the basis of these things, we are to believe. He gives a very different understanding of faith than what the common view is today, doesn't he? And I think we need to be careful not to confuse these two. The Bible's always adamant that faith is based on good and adequate reasons. People are never asked in the Bible just to keep quiet, stop asking questions, and you know, just believe without asking too many difficult questions. That's not real faith. We have evidence. We have these eyewitness accounts in the Gospels and throughout the Bible. Accounts of God's working and his plan of salvation and the person and the work of Jesus Christ. And this evidence should be adequate for us, if indeed these eyewitnesses are true and credible. I believe that the blue whale exists because I've met people who've seen them. And I've seen people on television talking about them. In other words, I've come across some credible sources which claim that the blue whale exists, and I've believed those sources. Why do you believe that your husband or wife loves you? Well, surely, above all, it's because you trust them. You know they wouldn't lie to you. They're credible witnesses to the fact that they love you. Just one other example. 2 weeks ago, it turned out to be the most expensive week of my life, I think, so far. I had to renew my car insurance and my MOT in the same week. Always a bit of a blow to the pocket. I didn't know there was anything seriously wrong with my car until I got that dreaded phone call from the garage where the car was in for its MOT. And I knew it was really bad when the guy on the other end asked me if I was sitting down before he told me how much it would cost. I don't know anything about cars. I'm useless, to my shame. So in a sense, I was completely at their financial mercy. They could have told me anything and I wouldn't have known any better. And yet I did end up shelling out the amount of cash, and boy was it a lot of cash to shell out, to get my car fixed and through the MOT and back on the roads. Why did I do that? Why did I pay them, even though I couldn't tell if they were, what they were saying was true or not? Well, it's because beforehand, everyone in the office at work, people who I trust, people who I know to be credible and reliable, people who have no motive for lying to me about this, they told me that this was a good garage, that they would do an honest job for me and that they wouldn't stitch me up. And so on that basis, I thought, well, it's a lot of money, but it needs doing. And so I'll pay up. I'm sure a lot of you can probably sympathise with that situation, although I'm sure many of you know a lot more about cars than I do. But you see the point, don't you? I'd weighed up, I'd found out, I'd researched, seen if these guys were credible, see if I could trust what they were saying to me. And having seen that I could, I believed what they said. Have you tested the evidence of the Bible and the eyewitnesses that are in there? Have you looked for yourself to see if John and the other authors of the Gospel, are they credible witnesses or not? Can we believe them? Can we trust what they're saying? Surely there couldn't be a more serious question to ask, more serious evidence to put to the test. In some ways, it's fairly small fry whether or not the garage was right or not about my car. But if John is right, then that has huge implications, massive implications for each one of us. If John is right, then Jesus is both your Lord and your God. And that makes a huge difference, surely, to the way we live our lives. A phenomenal difference. And so shouldn't this, surely this has got to be something worth looking into. Please, please do your own work on this one. Look into the evidence. If you'd like some help to do that, then I'm sure we at the church would love to help you to investigate that if you haven't done already. And so talk to me or one of the elders if you'd like to do that. But please do test the evidence and look into it. Weigh up, are these guys credible or not? Or maybe you're at this stage that Thomas was at, a bit further on from the first weighing up of the evidence, and you've seen enough evidence, and yet you keep demanding more and more evidence. That was what I think is at the root of Jesus' rebuke of Thomas. Thomas had spent years with Jesus. He'd seen him perform miracles. He'd heard him teach. He'd seen him live his life out. At least 10 of Thomas's closest friends, we read in verse 24 and 25, they told him that they'd seen Jesus alive again. 10 of his closest friends, and still he wanted more evidence. Maybe you've been weighing up the evidence for a long time now. Can I challenge you? What's your alternative explanation, if you're like Thomas here? Do you have a more adequate way of explaining these events of 2,000 years ago? Or are you simply doubting for the sake of doubting? If that's the case, then Jesus' command to you is the same as his command to Thomas. Stop doubting and believe. Stop disbelieving and believe. Or maybe you're even further on than that this morning, and you do believe, but you still have doubts. We all have doubts, don't we? I'm talking to Christians here. I have doubts. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you've had those times where you're driving along in the car or lying awake at night or doing the ironing or whatever it might be, and the thought pops into your head, what if I've been conned completely? What if my life's a farce because it's built on these wrong beliefs? These things aren't true and my life's just been a waste as a result. Well, please be assured of this from what John says here. Your faith isn't a blind leap in the dark. There is strong, historically attested eyewitness evidence for what you believe. Your faith is a rational faith. It's based on good and adequate reasons. Richard Dawkins, Southampton University professors, and your colleagues at work who frankly think you're a bit of a weirdo because of your beliefs, they don't have the monopoly on rational thinking based on reasonable evidence. And I don't say that we should be proud, but I don't think we should be paranoid either. And finally, in conclusion, this faith, it brings the reward of life in the name of Jesus Christ. The consequence of believing, John says, is that you may have life in his name. And there's a whole other sermon that we could go through on what John means by life in his name. It's another huge theme in John's gospel. But in summary, John tells us that this life, well, it begins the moment we believe, when we are born again, as John calls it. It's eternal, it goes on forever and ever. The alternative to having this life is perishing. There's no neutral territory on this one. You have life forever or you perish forever is the stark reality that John paints for us. This life is freely given by Jesus Christ to all who believe. And it's a life which is full and ultimately satisfying. If you want this life, it can begin now. Just listen to Jesus' words, obey his commands, look at the evidence, stop doubting, and believe.